You're listening to Oh My Pawn with George Takei and Todd Beaton. Hate groups are not a new phenomenon, but with the advent of the internet, they have spread farther and wider than ever before. And with a white nationalist in the White House, members of far-right hate groups have become emboldened to come out of the shadows and be open about their views. On this episode of Oh My Pod, we'll explore how the internet has enabled these groups to recruit and spread their hateful ideology, but also how it has empowered others to organize against them and root them out. Welcome to Oh My Pod. Hi, Todd. Good to be with you again.
Hi, George. Another light topic this week.
Well, hate groups are an important topic.
No, totally. And, you know, George, you've seen the face of hatred and division firsthand during World War II. Can you talk about how fear of the other spreads and takes root as hate?
Well, at that time, I was a five-year-old kid and not really understanding what was happening. But later on, as a teenager, I had many after-dinner conversations with my father. And I realized, you know, I was categorized as an enemy alien at 5 years old. But I wasn't an enemy. I was a five-year-old kid. And I wasn't an alien. I was born in Los Angeles, California. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. And so we were, you know, totally misidentified, but it was a convenient way for people's hate of us to be exercised. This country was swept up with racism and war hysteria, and so it was very easy for them to round us up with no due process. There were no charges, no trial. And yet the soldiers came stomping up our front porch, armed with bayoneted rifles, and they ordered us out of our home and put us in barbed wire prison camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that fear of the other, as represented by your family, all, you know, Japanese Americans.
120,000 of us.
Too many people whose fear was stoked by leaders sort of saw you as the enemy. And that fear turned into hatred.
Leadership is critically important when it comes to hysteria and racism combined. Unfortunately, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was stampeded. He was a fallible human being. My father, later on, when we were teenagers, reminded me that FDR did great things back in the 30s when we were in a crushing depression. Mm-hmm. But he himself is a human being, mm-hmm. and he made a mistake, got stampeded, and put innocent people, 120,000 of us, in barbed wire prison camps. It takes a leader to foment fiction.
Because I feel like after 9/11, there was a similar anti-Muslim fervor in the country, right? There was fear of the other, that we were just attacked. And George W. Bush actually did step up and say, you know, Muslims are not our enemy.
And he had, as a member of his cabinet, a Japanese-American who grew up in American concentration camp, Norm Mineta, former Congressman Norm Mineta, Secretary of Transportation. And he pointed him out to his fellow cabinet members. He said, we don't want what happened to Norm to happen again. And the first thing that he did after 9/11 was to visit a Muslim temple in Washington, D.C. And he said, we are not against Muslims. We are against terrorists. Mm-hmm. He made that very clear. But the nation still was seething with some hate there.
Yes. So now, obviously, we have Donald Trump, who doesn't tamp down any hatred, does he?
No, he doesn't. In fact, he is a leader in inflaming. But, you know, he does it in steps. After Charlottesville, Donald Trump said, there are good people on both sides.
Yep.
That was a, in quotes, moderate statement. And then he builds on it and builds on it.
And he sends a message to a white nationalist that
exactly.
he is one of them, that you are heard, and he emboldens them. He
exactly.
sort of brings it to the surface, whereas before they had been hiding.
And when it began with good people on both sides, it's now, oh yes, they are good people, the white nationalists. So, you know, he knows he's clever at orchestrating the stages. First the prelude and then the main crescendo.
Yes. He builds it like a story and a drama. Yes, that's true. It's really been disturbing just how they've really come out of the woodwork. The alt-right, white nationalists.
The Proud Boys says it all. They're proud of their ideology because someone like them sits in the Oval Office.
Exactly. And they're even organizing within the Republican Party.
Yes, indeed.
On this episode, I'll speak with Melissa Ryan, who has been tracking online hate groups, including the alt-right, through her organization Control Alt-Right Delete.
What a wonderful name. Wish we could delete them.
Exactly. And we'll speak with Daryl Lamont Jenkins of One People's Project, who has been following and destabilizing far-right hate groups before the internet was even a thing. And he explains why we all should consider ourselves anti-fascists.
It's a good one.
Thanks, George.
You're listening to Oh My Pod. But first...
Right now, I'm speaking with Melissa Ryan, a longtime digital strategist who writes the Control Alt-Right Delete newsletter and founded Card Strategies, which works to help people, policymakers, and institutions combat extremism and online toxicity. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, we go way back to our progressive blogging days. Good to speak to you again.
It's true. We are old and old friends.
Yes, exactly. So you've been studying the rise of the alt-right and white nationalism, including how they've spread online since 2016. Is that right?
Yeah. I started taking notes during the election year when I was working for a few candidates. And I noticed that things were just very strange online. Everything that the left was doing that should be popping in a presidential year just wasn't and seemed to be falling flat online. And everything Trump was doing was overamplified. And then I also noticed this extremist language and rhetoric and content that wasn't just there, but also seemed to be just extremely overamplified online. And it really wasn't until one of the Democratic debates when I tweeted something that I thought was pretty innocuous about Hillary Clinton. And I found myself the victim of attack of online trolls for just days and days on end. My mentions became a dumpster fire, and I was both terrified, but also, you know, again, from my experience as a digital organizer, I was like, oh, this is obviously strategic. Mm-hmm. It's obviously organized. So my first really diving into it was tracing back my own attacks from trolls. So I just started by monitoring the folks that I knew had attacked me.
Yeah.
After the election, I decided that it was too important to monitor, and I decided to make it my job, which is how the newsletter started and, you know, eventually the consulting practice as well.
So tell us about the newsletter. What's your goal with that?
Well, the goal initially was to just share what I was learning as I was with colleagues and friends who I thought would be interested. The first edition went out to 200 people. Fast forward to today, we have over 15,000 subscribers. And the goal of the newsletter is that every Sunday night in your inbox, you get a recap of everything that you need to know of important news in extremism and online toxicity that happened and what you need to know for the following week. Again, it was initially for folks who worked in politics and activism, but I think it's really broadened out to, you know, what you need to know as a citizen, just trying to function in America right now.
So what have you found? Can you give our listeners a sort of primer on the rise of the alt-right?
Yeah. So the alt-right itself is sort of a controversial term, largely because that's what these far-right folks started calling themselves as a rebranding.
Right. So it's the so-called alt-right. That's what you call them, correct?
Yeah, I try to use the so-called alt-right. But it's sort of this awful online convergence of traditional offline white supremacist groups, gamergate culture, far-right politics, and a thing that we don't talk about enough, which is very heavy Silicon Valley influence. So in 2013, TechCrunch ran an article, Geeks for Monarchy, talking about this group, that the school of thought that eventually became what we'd now think of as the so-called alt-right. It had proponents like Peter Thiel and Curtis Yarvin, names that you still hear all the time associated with Trump and Trumpian politics. And they were arguing that democracy was bad because it disrupted the natural order, i.e. white men are in charge of everything, and that the best way to solve this was a return to monarchy, which was treated as a very comical thing at the time. Like TechCrunch's piece was like, obviously, this will never become a mainstream political movement, but because influential people in tech are involved in it, it's worth covering. Fast forward 4 years later, it seems like a big part of the engine that charged this movement and primed it and got it together for, you know, when Trump became a candidate. I think it's really important also to think about right now, they're, you know, not a fringe group. The so-called alt-right, they have aligned themselves with Trump and MAGAland. They are the party in power. There are white supremacists and conspiracy theorists serving in Congress, serving in the Trump administration in all various offices, continuing to run for political office. And we know some white supremacist groups, Identity Europa, probably most famously, who are trying to infiltrate Republican parties at the local level so that they can completely take over the Republican Party from the ground up.
Wow. And so they see the Republican Party as their best chance, right? So that they don't have to create their own party.
Yeah. So Patrick Casey actually makes this point pretty explicitly. Identity Europa had a bunch of private Discord chats that were leaked by Unicorn Riot. And he talks specifically and often about the importance of members joining the Republican Party at the local level, because it was easy to build power at the local level and an easy way to infiltrate the Republican Party with more radical views.
Has Trump emboldened a movement that was already there? Do you think he served as a recruitment tool? Where was it pre-Trump, do you think, relative to today?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I think of this as a convergence of several disparate movements, both traditional offline white supremacist groups and these new Gamergate folks. Trump gave them something to rally around, gave them a leader. I've sort of come to think of Trump as a catch-all end of days cult,
okay.
You know, because he gathers white supremacists and conspiracy theorists and Christian fundamentalists, and pretty much if you think the world is going to end or should end badly, Trump has kind of become your guy. So he's built quite a terrifying coalition and used the organizing infrastructure of the Republican Party to do it.
So outside of infiltrating the Republican Party, what tools do they use?
Yeah, I mean, so there is not a community that is easier to join than the far right online. Because there are no rules, and there is very little you can say or do to get you banned. It is not as open as it once was a few years ago. I would say in 2016, 2017, these folks openly planned trolling and disinformation campaigns on message boards like 4chan and 8chan. A lot of that has since moved to private chats, but these message boards and online communities still serve as, you know, sort of the gateway drug for deeper involvement.
And what about just tactically? So obviously there was the Pepe the Frog meme.
Yeah, I think memes and meme culture are a very important part of understanding these on, you know, far right online communities and Trump world in particular. You know, they speak in the language of memes. The other thing that's interesting about memes is it's really important to understand that a lot of what these folks are doing is they're not creating culture, but they're stealing it. Pepe was stolen from a comic book artist, Matt Fury, who has since sued anyone and everyone he can to stop using likeness as a meme online. And it's fascinating, like, for all the credit they get for driving and creating culture, so much of what they're doing is stealing popular internet stuff that's already there. And repurposing it for their own uses.
Where's the concerted sort of campaign of disinformation that you witnessed online in 16, and that certainly was perpetrated against the United States by whether it was Russia, whether it was Cambridge Analytica? What do you see as far as that disinformation campaign goes?
It's still a problem. America has not really done anything, our government at least, to address what happened in 2016. So Russia and other foreign hostile actors know that we are vulnerable and we will do nothing to protect ourselves. But what really doesn't get talked about enough is that political operatives have been absorbing these same lessons, and they saw what worked in 2016 in terms of disinformation. And they are going to deploy some of these tactics as well. And then we have, at least for Facebook, Facebook has said they're not going to take down ads from politicians that contain disinformation. So that sends a signal. You've already got the Trump campaign. They are running disinformation about former Vice President Biden and his son's supposed connections to Ukraine. That's not going to stop. And hilariously enough, our agency that regulates this stuff, the Federal Elections Commission, is basically defunct under the Trump administration because they don't have enough commissioners to operate. So even campaigns who want to do right can't ask for an opinion. And it gives license for political operatives to use a lot of these same tactics because they know there's not going to be anyone to stop them.
Well, what about deplatforming? Where would you say we are in that process?
We know that once tech companies finally take action and take down these online communities that spread hate and these figures that spread hate and harm, they tend to go away and they're not able to be influential anymore. I think the best example of that is 8chan, which was taken down by Cloudflare, their DNS host, who refused to service them anymore, essentially shutting the platform down. So I am a big fan of deplatforming as a tactic. And I think we ought to talk about how to do that more broadly and systemically.
Is there one company that you've seen has been more aggressive than others? I know YouTube has taken down and demonetized some of its more toxic users.
Yeah, well, none of the tech companies are doing enough. And I think what's important to understand about all of them is they pretty much see this still as a PR crisis and not a crisis for their users. When hate and harm and harassment are allowed to spread online, it puts the vast majority of these tech companies' users at risk. And tech companies have done very little to address this. And generally what it takes is it takes a tremendous amount of public pressure from journalists and advocates. And so first you have to pressure the tech companies to have a policy, and then you have to pressure them to enforce it multiple times.
Can you talk a little bit about how New Zealand reacted in the wake of white supremacist violence there? And does that sort of pave the way for us here?
I think a lot about how the U.S. has reacted to domestic terrorism and mass shootings versus how New Zealand reacted, because it was just a completely different approach, both culturally and politically. The New Zealand government immediately took measures on gun control. The prime minister refused to say the shooter's name or amplify him in any way and made it very clear that hate has no place in New Zealand. New Zealand media organizations agreed in covering the trial. They came to a common agreement on how they could cover the trial without amplifying hate or amplifying the shooter's message. And then they've also taken a global approach. You know, they have organized summits with other countries and other civil society organizations about how to work on improving social media and stopping radicalization and use some of their, you know, soft power to pressure tech companies. So it's just a completely different approach. And I think it's a good guidepost for America when we finally decide enough is enough. And we want to put an end to both mass shootings and domestic terrorism inspired by white supremacy.
Absolutely. And it's an acknowledgement that it sort of bubbles up online.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, these I don't recommend necessarily reading these manifestos because, again, I don't want to amplify the ideas, but I have read them. It's fascinating how they're more like press kits. There's not much original. They're just repeating the same racist talking points over and over. They know how to include lines to try to get press, but basically, these are documents that are written knowing that folks will read them after they have committed this act of terrorism. These are documents written with the goal of making them go viral.
What's your advice for the rest of us to combat it in our own lives?
I think continuing pressure on the tech companies is one of the most important things that we as individuals with social media accounts can do. We are consumers, and we know that the only time they really make change is when they feel a critical mass of public pressure has come to them. I think also, you know, voting in 2020 and voting for a government who will address these issues is going to be important and is going to be crucial. I think the thing that frustrates me most about this space is folks offer individual solutions for huge systemic problems. And the reality is, whether we're talking about disinformation, whether we're talking about extremism and white and male supremacy, these are systemic problems that require systemic fixes. So I feel like energy can best be directed towards systemic solutions.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much, Melissa. This has been an excellent conversation, albeit a bit of a downer.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Of course.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe. After a quick break, Todd chats with political activist Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who has been working to expose neo-Nazis for over 30 years.
I'm speaking now with Daryl Lamont Jenkins of the One People's Project. Daryl has been tracking and fighting against the alt-right for decades now and founded the One People's Project in 2000, is that right?
Yes.
Can you tell us about how you got inspired to take on these groups?
Well, it was something that I had been doing pretty much all of my life. I've been doing this for about 30 years. I was always fascinated by the history of the civil rights movement. My father always got me into it. Mother and them, they were all a part of it back then. And it was always a case of me wondering, well, what happened to all the racists that we had to deal with? Because when you're like 10 or 11, you don't see the racism. You don't see it. And then the curious thing about 1978 is that they didn't have any problems putting Ku Klux Klan in your weekly reader. So that's how I realized that they were still around.
Wow.
So cut to maybe about 10 or 11 years later, I'm in the Air Force. I'm watching Oprah Winfrey, and she has a TV show about skinheads. And that was when I decided, you know what, I'm going to start documenting everything. And basically what that meant at that time was every time I saw them on TV, on one of these talk shows, I would just hit record and just keep all the footage for later, just following them that way until I found another way to track them.
Well, so what was that? That was basically at that point just television, right?
Yeah, it was just television.
And skinheads were the embodiment of neo-Nazism, white nationalism, whatever you want
well,
to call
whatever,
it.
Well, whatever. They called themselves skinheads, but for the record, they're not regarded as skinheads in my book or pretty much the book of decent folks. So, but yeah, I get your point. I see your point. And true, yeah, that was pretty much who we saw as the enemy, who we saw as the people pushing forward a lot of the hate mongering that was going on. But the thing is, it wasn't just there. When I got out of the Air Force, I started paying attention to a lot of other arenas where I noticed that a lot of the rhetoric that you heard from the Klan or Aryan Nations or the boneheads out there, that's what we call skinheads.
Okay.
or the boneheads, basically, you also started to hear on talk radio and certain right-wing newspapers. Pat Buchanan was the first one to make me raise my eyebrows to that one. When you start seeing it being played out in regular mainstream society, so I said, okay, if the Klan and all of them are complaining about affirmative action and they are complaining about affirmative action, then something is going on in the middle. Mm-hmm. So basically that's what started showing me that I have to start looking at those kind of connections as well.
And, oh, interesting.
And curious enough, those connections are real.
And within the mainstream of the Republican Party, right?
Then, especially then, it's funny how to look at some of the stuff now, when you start seeing the things that were going on back then, and we always talk about how there is no way they will be able to get away with saying this and that today. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a reason for that. We're in the room now in the mainstream of society, and we can tell people, yo, this person's a problem. And we start noticing there was a prominent group for like all of the 90s, especially around during Clinton's impeachment, called the Council of Conservative Citizens. And you start looking into that group a little bit more. I mean, you're talking about an organization that had their conferences shown on C-SPAN, had elected officials like Trent Lott and Bob Barr speaking at their conferences. And then you look into the more Council of Conservative Citizens came out of the white citizens councils of the 60s, and they still had the same attitude then and still do today. Wow. I mean, they refer to the Klan as vigilance committees. So,
Wow.
So So that's where you start seeing the connections. It's not the only kind of connection. Right now, I understand people were talking about, the Young Americas Foundation, who basically brings right-wing speakers to college campuses, just ousted Michelle Malcolm because she wouldn't disavow some anti-Semites that people were concerned about. Well, if you look at Michelle Malkin's history, she has written for white nationalist websites such as VDare.
Yeah. Why would this be surprising?
It's surprising that they got caught. I mean, it's right. Surprising that we're talking about it now. But you know what? It makes me happy that mm-hmm. we are finally doing that because they've gotten away with it for way too long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my group and a lot of other groups out there have been sounding the alarm saying, look, you can complain about the Nazis in the street yelling and screaming on courthouse steps all you want. Look in those boardrooms. They're not making any bones about how they are. Why are you not saying anything about them? Mm-hmm. Now we are. Mm-hmm. Now we are. So, you know, I'm glad that it's happening. Maybe you could say it's a little too late, but no, it's not. We can still fix this before they start doing anything.
Yeah. Well, so what did you seek to do by finally establishing an organization, One People's Project? Like what was your goal with that organization?
To diminish their ability to function.
Okay.
That's what I tell people. I says, look, we are going to seek them out. We're going to find out who they are, how they operate, and let everybody know. And when everybody knows, they're going to say, okay, we have to remove that person. And we've been successful in that regard. I mean, today they call it doxing. Back then, we called it reporting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's been our mission, just to basically monitor these groups and individuals and encourage everybody to be proactive against them.
Okay. So how is the internet – I mean, I imagine the internet has helped you in this endeavor, but it's also helped them spread?
Well, it's interesting because when you go through the history of the internet, when you start looking at groups like White Aryan Resistance and the Aryan Nations from back in the 80s, they were among the first to utilize the internet.
Okay.
When they had those message boards and such back then. When we started getting onto the internet – in mass back in like 95, 96. I remember Village Voice had an article about how they were using the internet and such. But the truth of the matter is, I think we used it better.
Okay.
All the work that I did prior to the internet was basically me, hey, listening to talk radio and recording. I'm watching somebody on, watching some news account on TV and recording. The internet gave me an opportunity to take those recordings and have everybody else listen to them as well.
Exactly, yeah.
It also gave me an opportunity to report the way I wanted to. My vocation is journalism. Okay. I used to write columns for daily newspapers like the Courier News. I used to edit one back home in New Jersey. But the internet gave me that soundboard that I needed. And when the way we started was that there was a white supremacist rally taking place in Morristown, New Jersey. We wanted to let people know what was going on. We started a website. We started a website to basically encourage people to come out and oppose them. And we called it the One People's Rally. Our counter protest was the One People's Rally. And we, after the rally, we kept the website going to help people who were arrested at the time and also let people know where all the people we were dealing with were going, mm-hmm. what they were doing since the rally.
Yeah.
And that became the One People's Coalition, and eventually the coalition fell apart, but we still kept the organization going, so we just changed it to One People's Project, and that's where we are today.
And how has social media helped your ability to call out alt-right?
Made it even easier. I mean, it's one thing to have a website.
Yeah.
One thing to have a media soundboard like that. When Facebook came along, when Twitter came along, it gave us a chance to even promote that even further. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a double-edged sword. They can too. I mean, hey, that's the way it goes. But the truth of the matter is we are able to utilize it better. We are able to reach a lot more because this is where people are at. We don't want to have the hate mongering. We don't want to have the racism and the bigotry. So when we see somebody fighting it, and when we, or more to the point, when we see somebody engaging in it, and we have the wherewithal to do something about it, we do something about it. And our website, the social networks, show people exactly how to do that.
So what are the tactics that you guys use to call out white nationalists?
Well, as I said before, I mean, we're reporters. We're journalists. We research. And we let people know what is going on out there. And, you know, the most important weapon in our arsenal is the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, that may sound, you know, in this day and age, that may sound, I guess, jingoistic, but it's not. That is the truth. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you go out there and tell people the facts, tell people exactly what is going on, let them lie. Let them pull their conspiracy theories out their behinds, you know. All we have to do is just maintain what we have been saying all along. People will see it. People will recognize the truth versus the fantasy that they come up with.
Well, it is. I think we're finding in this moment where truth is called into question that it's a little more difficult to just present the truth and expect everyone to accept it.
It is. I mean, that's always been the case. But I would submit that even in this day of social networking, especially in the days of social networking, it's a lot easier to push back against that than it was, say, when talk radio was running things. When talk radio was running things and all we heard was the voices of Rush Limbaugh or Bob Grant or somebody like that. That was all we heard. We didn't hear any pushback. I don't know why, but we didn't hear any pushback. So their rhetoric became gospel, and nothing that was supposed to be the truth mattered.
Right.
Nothing.
Well, what about in this moment when the right-wing media ecosystem creates an alternative reality, really, for Trump supporters and those – I would say even white nationalists, the alt-right, they really seem to believe an alternate reality. How do you break through that?
Well, you can try as hard as you can. As I said before, I think basically the mission is to just tell the truth about things. Yeah, they create their alternate reality. But because you have groups like mine, because you have other media outlets like Unicorn Riot, which is another anti-fascist group, or It's Going Down, another one, we're able to just offset that in a big way. I mean, they say something stupid, we say something against it, and the rest is history.
Well, do you have an online army? How do you disseminate calls to action and information for people who support you?
Well, I don't know necessarily if it's an online army. One of the biggest online armies is really offline. Because the truth of the matter is, you unplug from that little cabal of right-wing propaganda and you step outside your door, you know immediately that what you just saw online was nonsense. So the biggest thing, and I always say this, the scariest three letters to that particular crowd is IRL. Because the truth of the matter is, truth of the matter is, once you go out there and see things for yourself, their rhetoric doesn't compute. It doesn't figure in. It is the most important thing. And the only thing that we can do is make sure that we point people in the direction where you can get the facts. They can't do that because everything they're about is a lie.
So your work has contributed to the collapse of right-wing groups around the country, yeah?
Yes.
So talk to me about how that's come about.
Well, I mean, not only do we research and find out information about these groups that caused them to fall apart, we also help to bring people out of those groups. When they get out of those groups, they bring a lot of information with them. Sometimes they bring the membership list.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, we caused some serious damage to groups like the National Alliance and Aryan Nations and groups like that. The National Socialist Movement, the leader of that group had a falling out with his wife. She gave us the membership list. We posted it.
Oh, my gosh.
1,500 names.
Wow. So how has the alt-right grown over the past few years that you've seen?
Well, here's the frustrating thing. Unfortunately, they can use the internet. And they can use the internet to recruit. And the fact of the matter is, they've always been around. When I was dealing with groups like the Council of Conservative Citizens, when you're talking about people who are politically connected the way they are, or when they're connected to academia, now you're not going to be looking for the people that are going to be standing on the courthouse steps yelling and screaming. Now you do have to go into the boardrooms. Now you do have to go into academia and see who's who and what's what. These individuals hold conferences. And the best thing for us in that regard was the fact that they were old and getting ready to die soon. But before they die, we would infiltrate their conferences and get all the information that we needed about those groups. Well, unfortunately, along came a guy named Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer found a way to basically recruit young people. And that's what we're dealing with now. We weren't dealing with young people back in the day. I mean, 2008, you saw a few young people here and there going to the conferences sponsored by that newsletter, American Renaissance. In 2011, Spencer put together a conference, amounted to just 50 old white guys in their like 70s and 80s.
Okay.
By the time 2016 came along, he had about 300 people at these conferences, and most of them young people. How did he do it? He started recruiting within the gaming community. He went to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, and held events at that time where there were a lot of young people trying to figure out how they're going to get their niche into conservative activism, and he pointed them in his direction. A lot of that effort on his part was the reason why we're dealing with the so-called alt-right today. And if it wasn't for Charlottesville, and I'm not thanking the Lord for Charlottesville or anything like that, but if it wasn't for Charlottesville, we wouldn't be pushing back on that as much as we couldn't beforehand.
Got it. I mean, it also helped their cause to have someone in the White House who they see as one of them, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting too because Donald Trump, whether or not win or lose, they were going to continue to do what they wanted to do. But now they have a little bit of juice and they're trying to basically use Donald Trump as their Hail Mary for all the things that have been changing over the past 50 years, even if they were only alive for maybe 20 of them. Mm-hmm. So even if Donald Trump wasn't there, they would still be doing this and they would still have their people in power in some way. I mean, everybody keeps forgetting that House Minority Whip now, Steve Scalise, used to call himself David Duke without the baggage.
Right.
Spoke at one of those conferences that I'm referring to, which was sponsored by David Duke.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, and yet he's there in Congress. I mean, yeah. So we had that. I mean, Richard Spencer was on his way to doing that, being that kind of person where he could either be a lobbyist or a politician. He was raising money for Ron Paul and such.
Wow.
But we were talking about him relentlessly since about 2006. So that killed his, profile. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew him to be a white supremacist. So he was allowed to get through the door. But he had a friend. He had a friend that he knew at Duke University by the name of Stephen Miller.
Oh.
And we didn't notice him. Uh-huh. So we didn't talk about him. Look where Stephen Miller is today.
Yeah, right.
We're trying to get him out of the White House now.
Oh, wow.
We don't have to try to get Richard Spencer out. That's why our work is important.
Yeah.
We got to keep an eye on everybody who was like, Stephen Miller.
Absolutely. So Trump emboldens them, mm-hmm. right? And so they actually think they can be more open about their beliefs. Mm-hmm. But what they're doing is showing their colors to the rest of us.
Yes. And in addition to that, we are also being galvanized. I mean, you take a look at the kinds of people that have been not just running, but winning. I mean, when you look at, so you have Andrew Gillum and you have a black man running for the governorship in Florida and you have a black woman running for governor in Georgia, and they barely lost.
Barely lost.
And people think really that there were shenanigans behind that. We don't know for sure, but hey, they barely lost is the important part.
Exactly.
Then there are those that have won. AOC. Mm-hmm. AOC came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the squad in general, mm-hmm. that is the future of politics today. The reason why is because we are getting fed up too.
Mm-hmm.
And we can actually express our fed upness a lot better than the so-called alt-right. How can you be a fed up millionaire as Richard Spencer is? What are you upset about? I'm hoping that you guys don't shoot me as I'm trying to be a millionaire.
Yeah, absolutely. So you consider yourself an anti-fascist. Can you define that term?
It's very easy. If you don't like fascism, you're anti-fascist. I mean, we know what fascism is. I know everybody likes to try to play. Do you really know what fascism is? Yeah, I'm fighting it. So I must know what fascism is. If you want to maintain that forced nationalism on everyone, I'm going to have an issue with it. And by the way, Antifa are not the true fascists because Antifa can't be because we're not about nationalism. If you are about nationalism and to the point that you are insisting that everybody acts the way you do, that acts, that promotes your nation or whatever, you're the fascist.
So, but define it a little more for our listeners, exactly what defines a fascist.
It comes from Mussolini and all that. We saw what happened and what he did in World War II. It's basically proclaiming your country above all else. Mm. You really are not an individual when you are a fascist. Mm. You have basically it's nationalists imposing an authoritarian rule over the land. And you have a certain way that you need to act and be if you're going to be of this land. So if you're not that, you're going to be X'd out. If that means even if you don't have control of that thing. So if you are a white nationalist and you're promoting your white land, the rest of us who aren't white are X'd out. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work in this country. That doesn't work in this society.
So what would you tell people about the anti-fascist movement who only know Antifa from the headline-grabbing anarchist actions?
Don't believe everything you read on the internet, for one mm-hmm. thing. But I would also say that you got to remember, consider the source. Think about who it is that's calling us out, who it is that are complaining about anti-fascism or Antifa. I would say that there are a lot of sources that you can go to. But what I always try to tell people, as I just said before, is that if you are against the hatred and bigotry that goes on in today's society, you are anti-fascist. That fascism is what you are fighting. So I always run it down. Hey, Martin Luther King was anti-fascist. You know, I mean, you take a look at Cesar Chavez was anti-fascist. The abolitionists of back in the day, they were anti-fascist, even though fascism wasn't a word yet, you know. So Andrew Jackson, he was a fascist.
Yeah. And isn't he Donald Trump's favorite president?
How ironic. No, how coincidental, actually.
So how can we all join in the fight against right-wing nationalism to combat this?
Well, I think it is a case of just being aware, and that's what One People's Project does. That's why I'm going out and doing documentaries and things like that. I mean, people see on Netflix, there's a documentary called Alt-Right Age of Rage, which was originally supposed to be about Trump's first year. But then after they came back from Charlottesville, became something else.
Oh.
It actually became a thing between me about me versus Richard Spencer, more or less.
Wow.
So I go out there and I promote that. I try to tell people this is what anti-fascism looks like. This is what fascism looks like. I think it's important to be aware of what it is that's out there trying to tear this society apart. You hear Lou Gohmert predicting civil war on the House floor? He has to go. Vote him out. He has no – I don't care if he's in a red state or in a red district. Anybody that is on the House floor talking about how there's going to be mm-hmm. a civil war in this country needs to go. Obviously, that person is not representing this society in this country. What is he doing there? Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of people that are like that. But that's just one example. Yeah, go out there and vote. But go out there and also and educate and create the institutions that keep that at bay, that prevent mm-hmm. Fascism from gaining a foothold in today's society. That's how it works. That's how we worked it over the past 50 years. We can keep doing that.
So where can people find you online to join the movement?
Well, I'm on onepeoplesproject.com. You can find us there. We also have a newsline, a website called IDAVOX. It's IDAVOX.com. I'm on Twitter and on Instagram as D. Lamont Jenkins. And like I said, you can also check me on documentaries like Alt-Right Age of Rage. And also there's a movie out called Skin, which is about a neo-Nazi that I helped get out of the white power scene. His name is Brian Widener. He's being played by Jamie Bell. Danielle McDonald is in it. Vera Farmiga is in it. Bill Camp, who had a brief role in Joker, he's in it. And Mike Coulter, who everybody knows is Luke Cage and is currently starring in the TV show Evil, he plays me. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's cool. All right. Well, thank you so much, Daryl, for joining us on Oh My Pod. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. George, have you noticed a rise in hate since Trump got elected?
Oh, my, yes. Oh, my.
Sadly, that's how it feels, right, in the country?
Almost every day you sense the hate at the core of Donald Trump.
One of his top advisors, Stephen Miller.
Oh, my God.
He's a white nationalist.
He's on the staff. And so, yes, he has in-house, right at his council, leader of the hate movement.
And it's really impacting policy.
Absolutely. I mean, look what's going on at the southern border. I mean, regularly and with newer variations to it. It's with hate.
That's what motivates it. I mean, obviously, the refugee policy, it taints everything. And it really does come down to this sort of white nationalist, racist hate.
And it's affecting our country with people who really are Americans in every respect except birth. Young people. I mean, they were brought here as infants at a very young age. They're American in every way. They speak English the way we do. They feel American, and they are contributing to American society, and yet they can't become citizens.
Exactly. That's a perfect example of how our United States policy from the very top is being driven by,
at its core, hate.
At its core, hate, xenophobia, racism. It really is a shame. And I do think that that seeps down into the culture.
To use his words, it's a disgrace.
What do you think of Daryl's point that calling these folks out publicly is one of the best ways to combat them?
Light is always the most powerful weapon to fight evil, to fight darkness. And calling them out and explaining their reality and putting them in the context of American ideals. I'm hopeful that as we change leadership after November's election, that this sort of hate will once again become unacceptable.
And go back into hiding.
Yes. We may not be able to do away with it entirely, but at the very least, we can limit its oxygen supply.
Exactly. Like with hope, with inclusion.
Ethics, values, the things that truly define our nation.
Exactly. I share that hope, George.
We do indeed. This has been Oh My Pod. George Takei's Oh My Pod is produced by Todd Beaton, Elizabeth Friedman, Evan Brechtel, Lorenzo Tione, Jay Kuo, and Tom Garuto. Special thanks to Gotham Podcast Studios.